All right, how's it going? I'm Isabel Wilkinson, and you are listening to Series 2 of the Artists in Residence podcast. I have long been frustrated by this niggling feeling I have that I want to create something, but I've never known where to start. So back in 2019, I asked myself the question, what is creativity and what forms can creativity take? My exploration led me to the concept of an artist in residence. For those that don't know, an artist residency is when an establishment, like a museum or a gallery, recruits a person or a group of people with a specific skill to produce work, provide advice, and share knowledge on a specific topic for a set period of time. I became fascinated by the role that the environment can play on the creative process. So I grabbed a mic and I headed into the homes and spaces of people who I could see were creating things on the regular. I spoke to 6 amazing people who worked in everything from fashion photography, storytelling, menswear design, to roasting coffee and even urban gardening. Then the pandemic hit in 2020, and like so many people, I found myself out of creator mode and into survival mode. Coming out of that survival mode, it felt more important than ever to use this platform to speak to the people who are creating and making things which set out to solve a problem or answer a big question. People who are using creativity for good. The Artists in Residence podcast exists to shine a spotlight on the people who are thinking differently to leave things better than they found them, looking at society's biggest issues and saying, I've got an idea for that. My guests share their inspirations, practical advice, and the challenges that they've faced along the way. I hope it inspires you to examine your corner of the world and to share the idea you have on how to make it better. Because when it comes to society, the planet, and people, we are all artists in residence. Today's episode is with Amy Falone, co-founder of independent children's publisher Knights Of and their community-led bookshop, Roundtable Books. After feeling frustrated and ready to give up on publishing following negative experiences of tokenization and feeling ignored, Amy got together with David Stevens to create great books which feature a whole range of characters with different perspectives and different identities to give kids great representation of who they really are. They've been successfully doing that since 2017, and today's episode begins with me congratulating Amy on their recent Nibbies win of Children's Publisher of the Year. I hope you enjoy this episode, find it useful, and I hope that it inspires you to create something good of your own today.
We did! Thank you. Yeah, complete surprise. I had no idea. Yeah. My half of the table was very much like, okay, yeah, happy to be here. Not really expecting anything. The other half were like, we've won. I can feel it. And I was like, and we won.
And you won. And how do you feel now? Are you still riding the wave?
I think I probably only rode the wave for a day.
Yeah.
And then I had to get back to my inbox because we are a really small team. And even though it's nice to like celebrate and take stock of like, oh my God, yeah, we've done this huge thing, I don't have time. Yeah. Like, I don't have time to really just bask in it. I wish I had more time. And probably maybe when we're like 10 years old or something, we can do a whole look back and I can stop for a bit. But I don't have time right now to think, oh my God, we're amazing. We've done this huge thing, which is all true, but also, I haven't got the time. I've got to do the work. Yeah. I've got to do the work, yeah.
So you won with Knights Of,
mm-hmm.
the publishing house
that mm-hmm.
you manage.
Managing director of, yeah. Yeah, I've been managing director now maybe a year. Maybe, I don't remember what time really is, but originally co-founded with David Stevens. For the past year, I think the focus has just really been making sure that the company is sustainable, that we are getting the best books out in the best way possible, making sure that our reader is always the center of everything that we do. You know, there's been a lot of conversation about what inclusion means, about what true diversity means. And I think whilst those are words that influence our ethos, they're not buzzwords at all for us. They are things that we literally implement into every aspect of every department of the company. So if that's design, if it's publicity, marketing, and even sales, like we just try to make sure that we're inherently inclusive, irrespective of what the rest of the industry thinks inclusion or diversity means. And I will try not to be too call-y-out-y of the industry, but I think there was definitely a peak time where it was like, oh my God, everyone was on the inclusion diversity train. And whilst it's good to be on the train if we're all going to the same place, I think everyone kind of has their own idea of what the end point is. Metaphors galore. But yeah, I think for us, we just want to make great books that feature a whole host and a whole range of characters from different perspectives, from different identities, and just give kids great representation of who they can be, who they are. Not shying away from big topics, but also not making that our focus. So we really do steer away from trauma narratives. Like, we don't have time for that at all.
So, Nights Of, mm-hmm. what's the idea behind Nights Of and subsequently Roundtable Books?
Yeah, Nights Of for me really came out of frustration. Like, I have been in corporate publishing now. Well, I was in corporate publishing at the time, probably for about like 5 years, three, four, 5 years, and really struggled with oftentimes being the only Black woman in the room, or indeed maybe the only Black woman in a department, or one of like three Black people in the entire office. And like, I really struggled with the identity that was put on me in terms of like, oh, Amy will know the answers to this, or Amy will become the spokesperson for that. And yeah, I really struggled with it, and in turn was just like, if there's nothing that can be done within the traditional space of publishing, what can be done outside of it? And I think that's when indie publishing really became attractive, and when it gave me another route to actually doing the work that I wanted to do, which is just, I know I say it in like the most offhanded way, but like creating great books that feature great characters. And like, that is it. Like, we're not changing the game of how we publish books. We're not publishing on like silk or like binding books in a fancy way. We're still creating like paperbacks and sometimes hardbacks, but ultimately I just wanted to make sure that the stories that I worked on, the authors, the illustrators, the teams that I worked in were reflective of not only my own background, but those of my friends, those of the people that I knew, and the stories that weren't being highlighted got a space to shine.
Absolutely. And so how long did Nights Of exist before you opened up this space, Roundtable?
Nights Of was, I think it was our first or second birthday. And at that same time, a report had come out from CLPE. I think it was their first report, actually, their Reflecting Realities report. And they were showing, you know, what Black, Asian, minority, ethnic protagonist representation looked like in children's books. And that first report showed that only 1% of children's books had Black, Asian, minority. 1%. And so then we kind of started a hashtag on Twitter, which was Read the 1%. So instead of like focusing on the huge 99% that doesn't exist, we were like, how can we focus on the 1% that does exist? And how can we kind of shine a light on the authors and their books? And so people like in comments or in like starting their own threads, like shouting out authors, and important to say like British authors as well, like homegrown authors that had existed historically and that, you know, whose books we could support and whose books we could buy. I think we were thinking, I think it was our first birthday. It was like, how can we celebrate our first birthday? We were like, oh, let's do a pop-up and let's put all the 1% books in a space and maybe people will come and buy them. And it was like literally as simple as that. And we reached out to Tales and Moon Lane, Tamara at Tales and Moon Lane, who we knew, who is another indie bookshop owner. We were like, we don't really know what we're doing in terms of book selling, but like, we'd really love to do this thing. And we found a space on Cold Harbor Lane, and she helped us with ordering books and running a till, which was a scratchy piece of paper ticking off books when we sold them. And in those 5 days, we sold over 500 books, and we had our great party, and yeah, it was spilling onto the street. And it was like, okay, well, there is demand, and there is like demand in Brixton for a space such as this. And more importantly, we had people from the community being like, okay, you're gonna be here next week. And we were like, just 5 days only. And they were like, no, you're gonna be here next week. And so we were all incredibly burnt out after those 5 days of book selling, and took, I think, like a week stock to be like, okay, do we want to do this again? Like, what does that look like? And I think we did some very like rogue tweeting to be like, oh, if we like did some polls and stuff, like if we ran a crowdfund campaign, would you back a permanent bookshop with actual money? And the response was overwhelmingly yes. And so we ran the pop-up again in December for 2 weeks and ran a crowdfund campaign, shot some very janky videos with the target of reaching £30,000, because that's what we thought we would need to hire a bookseller, but also to you know, rent a physical space, and we managed to raise, I think, £54,000 or something like that. We were on ITV News, in The Guardian, Channel 4, like we were picked up in the Metro, we were picked up by press, and I think it was a really good time, like just before Christmas, and people were really wanting to support something community driven. Yeah, again, like the pop-up space did really well in those 2 weeks. We had authors coming by, and we kind of just wanted to test out what a bookshop could look like in Brixton, and it did really well, and we got £15,000 from Penguin as well, which was very helpful. And then the May of the next year, we opened the space that we're in now. So not at all planned, but definitely one of the favorite parts of like this whole story of what Nights Of is and what it's evolved into is that the bookshop exists as a space where kids can come in, hopefully feel at home and feel as though they can see themselves and their friends in the books that we have in the shop, but also that we can go into communities where maybe bookshops aren't, and we can get authors there, we can get illustrators there, and we can get them great books as well.
And here it is. And here we are. So amazing to have that direct feedback from your customers, from the people who were like, this is what we've been missing.
Oh yeah, Brixton is very vocal. They were literally like tapping on the window, being like thumbs up through the window, or like waiting before we'd even open. Like they're a very vocal community about what they need and what they don't need as well. So yeah.
So the name Knights Of a Round Table, what's the inspiration?
So Knights Of was back to the Arthurian legend that everyone, we're actually sat around a round table. God, how on brand are we?
As if it was meant to be.
As if, is that everyone around the table has an equal voice, and that is how we treat the company. That's how we treat, I don't even really like to say employees, but like who people that we work with. Everyone in the company can pitch a book if that's what they want to do. Our editorial directors listening should probably be like, but like if anyone has an idea of like a person that we should be reaching out to, or you know, a voice that really needs to be elevated, like that's something that we always encourage, is that anyone can bring anything positive or criticism to us. It's making sure that we feel as though we work with people, not people work for us. And it's like a tiny thing in language, but it's something that I always try to make sure is present in everything that we say, is that we work with people, people don't work for us. And then when Roundtable Books, you know, the bookshop came along, we were like, oh well, we'd be missing a trick there if we didn't stick a round table in somewhere, and this is where Roundtable Books came from.
So to go back to the time, to your experience working in corporate publishing and the frustration that you felt with being, I guess, used as a voice to represent things that you had never suggested.
Not my job.
What you would do.
Yeah.
How did you go from, I'm incredibly frustrated, to, okay, so I'm now the managing director of, of a publishing house in my own right?
It started with a conversation in the hallway of the office that we used to work at, shall I say, David and I, and David asked me like, how am I? And at that point I was like, do you want the real answer, or do you want the answer that I kind of give to everyone at work? And they were like, oh no, the real answer. And I was like, well, actually I'm about to probably leave the industry because of the fact that I have been trying to do things with my then boss, but finding that there was a whole host of reasons why we couldn't get things put through, mainly money, which I don't believe to be true. And I was hearing things like, oh, you know, it's historically really hard to get these voices published, or there's no market for them, or we don't know where to find these readers. And like, I just grew incredibly like tired of that, alongside microaggressions that I was facing in the workplace as well. I had just got to the point where I was like, yeah, I love books. I've always loved books. Like, they're probably pictures of me. Mom tells a story about me having like an inflatable book that I had on a, in a pool when I was on holiday, and she's maintained she's got a picture somewhere. But like, I've always loved reading. Like, I've always been a huge reader. I'm an only child, so I really kind of use books as like my siblings or like my friends. But I was finding that that passion was being wiped out, and like I couldn't see it as much when I was within corporate publishing. And so I had that conversation with David, and we kind of just did some, and I hate to say this phrase, like blue sky thinking, like what would the dream be, you know? And the dream was to have a company. I don't even necessarily think I was thinking like my own at the time, but the dream would have been to like work in a company or have a company that, yes, was focused on inclusion and diversity, but didn't like beat you over the back with it. Like, it was just quarter their DNA. And so what started as like a conversation then became like, it just really snowballed into like a, well, what if instead of leaving to do nothing or leaving to switch industries, like we kind of tried to do this. And I was like, I'd literally, like, everyone always asked me, like, weren't you scared to leave your job? And I was like, I was at that point where I really disliked my job, that leaving to do this,
it wasn't feasible for you to stay.
And leaving to do this unknown, quote unquote, scary thing seemed like much more appealing than staying at my 9 to 5. So I was like, absolutely, yeah, I will risk it all. We put a pitch deck together, we sought out funding, I left my job, we managed to secure funding. 50 grand, I think, at the time, or 100 grand, which I do think is important to speak about money, because we don't in this industry, like, we don't talk about pay. We don't talk about how much it actually costs to get books in to market and on shelves.
How was that for the process? Had either of you had any experience doing that?
None
before?
At all. No. None at all. Absolutely none. And we kind of commissioned an illustrator to kind of give some vibrancy to the words on our page. But at the time, the report that I mentioned earlier, CLP's one, didn't exist. And so a lot of the numbers that we were pulling were anecdotal from like other people and other friends in other publishing houses, but we didn't have any statistics at the time. We do now, which is fortunate, but even things down to diversity within the workforce, those numbers didn't exist. So a lot of what we were doing was just like pre-conversation really kicking off. And so a great time for us, because we were able to kind of really help to lead the conversation, but also not helpful that we didn't have the numbers to back it up. But the pitching process was interesting. We only ever took one bad meeting where I was completely ignored the whole meeting. They didn't want to talk to me at all, and they only wanted to talk to David. And it was like, oh, okay, fine, we won't be doing any work with you. Absolutely not. But everyone else generally was on board, and we was in a really privileged position to be like, well, these are the investors that we want to have on our board. That was, I want to say, 1.5, 2 months of like running around with like a laptop and a, this is our presentation, before securing funding, and then maybe like another 4 months to actually get money into a bank account, lawyers and accountants and a whole world that we didn't even know. Like, I found our accountant at a women in business event or something, and I kind of went up to her after and was like, thinking of like launching a company, I don't know really what I'm doing. And she like took my take my card, and I was like, great. We've had Kate, our accountant, ever since. But it was a whole new world, and it was like a whole new shift of like thinking as well, to think that I'm no longer working for someone, I am now running everything, was the steepest learning curve. Like, I had done no preparation for that at all. Like, I went from being an assistant editor to like a co-founder,
running a whole business
within a matter of months. And there was huge gaps in my learning, and there was, you know, there were times I was like, this, I'm out of my lane here. But that's why it was important at the time, like, David was there, we were kind of going through that together. There's a whole world behind like walking into a bookshop and seeing the book on the shelf that has to be kind of walked through before you can even get that book on the shelf. So that was, yeah, that was a period of time.
I can imagine. And so whilst waiting for that funding, mm-hmm. were you both working?
No.
But we were just
working on nights off. We had both depleted all of our savings, like, until we were getting, and we took, once money was in the bank, we took very nominal, very, very nominal wages, but it was we weren't doing anything else. I think maybe sometimes we'd write something for a publication or like, but you're talking about like 75 to 100 pounds, you know, for a fee. Like, we were just depleting our own accounts until we could take a salary from KO. But when we launched, we didn't even have any books. We didn't launch with any books because we didn't have any, but we were just really eager to launch the company. And even though we didn't have any books, we launched with a blog page, which was Books Made Better. The idea behind that was to give voice to the community that were within publishing and the authors that did exist, and to give them like a safe space to kind of talk about whatever they wanted to talk about. And so we published some anonymous letters to the industry from people that were within it, who were just like, I've had enough, like, right, you know, who wanted a safe space to say, this is my treatment, you know, this is how I've been dealt with, and this is what I've noticed, and it's not good enough. And then we were also shining a light on books that did exist, and authors and illustrators, because whilst Knights of is doing something unique, we also realize that historically there have been publishers and people that have come before us, and that this isn't something new for a lot of people who have been doing this work tirelessly, like decades and decades before us. Like, we're not the only ones, and I think we would have been really naive and can't think of the word, but like in a gross way, like we could have easily come in and be like, oh, this is all us. Like, we've started this conversation, and forgetting that actually there have been, a lot has come before. And I remember having a conversation with Mary Blackman, like really early on. And she was like, you know, I see this in a 7-year cycle. She was like, I see like the conversation around diversity and inclusion reach its peak. And then I see like some really great publishing, and then like it will drop off. Since the 70s, she's noticed this kind of trend of like this 7-year thing where there will be this heightened awareness. Exactly.
Awareness, and then drops,
and then it drops off. And she was hopeful, and I think that's sometimes I am not as, but she was still hopeful that, you know, with organizations that have existed and that are continuing to do the work, that that would eventually change and the cycle would die off. But she did say, yeah, I've seen this. Like, I've been here, I've, you know, 30 plus years, I know what this is. So I think to ignore the people that have kind of been the founding and done building work that we are fortunate enough to kind of sit on top of would have been really, really rude.
I think that that hopefulness is a really interesting thought. And I like wonder, to go back to that, I guess even like the first year of you and David running this, how did you like motivate yourself in that time? How did you wake up every day and go, as you say, you depleted your savings, you've had some good conversations, but you're speaking to other people who are saying, well, I've seen this before. How did you keep going, I guess, and feel enthusiastic?
I think at that, when I look back on it now, we did an awful lot. There wasn't a panel where the word diversity and or inclusion was in where my face was not there or David was not speaking about something. And I think whilst it was helpful for us to get our mission and ethos out, when I look back on it now and when I look at the amount of work I do now, I do considerably less. Like, I do markedly, I do probably 80% less than I did back then. But in order to make people recognize that what we're doing isn't just for a moment, but it is for, like, I see this as legacy, and I say that openly. I do see like the work that we're doing at Knights of as legacy, and like in the next 20, 25, 30 years, I don't want to be the only person like who people come to talk to about it. Like, I want to be one of the, not, I want to be one of the people that helped found the company, but I want to give space to others to kind of run with it and ensure that it is here for decades and decades to come. And so having that in mind and kind of knowing from the beginning that this isn't just for a short time, that we weren't around for not a long time, but also like we were here for the good time and the long time.
Just giving me goosebumps.
Oh,
I think it's so amazing to hear somebody so clearly say, I'm building this for good.
Oh, absolutely.
For the long term.
Absolutely. It would take a lot for KO to, God forbid, crumble, because I would be hanging on by, you know, whatever means possible. Because I think to kind of prove, like, I try not to think about what other people think, but to prove that like there is worth in these stories, and that these stories do have a place, and that they can be commercial, and that they don't have to be stereotypical, we have to be here for the long term. And we don't have to go toe to toe with the big five. Like, I can't even, you know, compare us, because their reach and our reach, very different things. What we're doing and what they're doing are very different. And I would be naive to think that their reach and our reach are the same things, but we do some things better than them, and we are able to reach places and have conversations and be in rooms that they aren't. And I think it's how you grow and develop that to make sure that it lasts, rather than is, you know, just seen as a thing that pops up. And then, like, how sad would it be to be like, oh yeah, they did all of this and they won a whole Nibbies, what happened to them? Okay, yay for awards and all of that, but it doesn't matter if we're not reaching the kids who need the books. And that's the thing that I will always say, is that it's always, always about the kids, you know?
And how do you keep that front of mind?
Not in a selfish way, but I do try to think of like the younger version of me. And I think about how much I loved reading and loved going to the library but didn't ever really see myself in the pages of the books that I read or on the covers of the books that I read. And I think about the books that I did go towards, like I remember reading Purple Hibiscus by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie way too young, and Alice Walker way too young. But I think, you know, how powerful would it have been to be able to pick up books from a young age that reflected my experience and again reflected the experience of my friends and people that I didn't even know. And I try to give my younger self through the work that we do at Nights of the books that didn't exist, you know. And I think thinking of my younger self, but also thinking of all of the children now who are way more eloquent than I ever was and have words for feelings and thoughts that I just never had language for, and how they're also bold now. I think they are right to call us out for the work that we're not doing, and they are the ones that I often look to be like, what is it that you need and how can we help do that? You know, because ultimately they're the ones who are going to grow up, and they are, not to sing song lyrics at you, but they are the future. And like, what are the generations? I start singing. Absolutely not. Like, what are we giving them as like the building blocks of their life, if not the best writing, if not the best representation, if not authors and illustrators that push boundaries and show them all the possibilities of who they can be? So I really try to keep them, like, through all the meetings and all the boring things that obviously are part and parcel of running a business, I try to remember that it's not for myself, but it's for like the kids to come and the kids who are here now.
Making sure, as you say, that they've got the right books at the right time.
Exactly.
So you're not reading books that are
Way too old for you. Yeah, content matter is ridiculous.
But there's characters at the right time.
Yeah. Yeah, so that they know that they can turn to like X author or Y author and think, oh my God, yes, I know I can escape here, or I know I can see my favorite characters here, or I can have my mind open to something new here, or I can laugh at silly fart jokes, you know, because it's not always, there's a place for all of it, and there should be a place for them in all of it too.
To talk about creativity, because this is what I'm obsessed with, and I'm so interested in speaking to people who can see a problem, a huge one or a tiny one. They're frustrated, they don't feel like their voice is being heard, and thinking differently, not necessarily reinventing the wheel, but just thinking differently from the people who've too long made all the decisions to do something different. And I wondered, do you view yourself as inherently creative?
It's funny because I feel as though I work with a lot of creative people and I work in a creative industry, but I don't know that I would call myself, like, I always feel like a bit of an imposter when people are like, I'm not a creative. I'm absolutely not, because maybe I don't create the work, I just create. I guess it depends on what you see as the definition of creative, because I know that we create space, right? And so we create space for authors and illustrators to do what they do best. And so in that kind of definition of am I creative, yes, I help to create space and I help to facilitate space where people can have the freedom to do their work in the best way possible. But because I'm not outputting anything, I don't think I would.
Apart from my business.
Workshop
and making sure it keeps
running. I struggle with that one. I do. I think I can help to create space, but I'm not necessarily the one who is, like, the space is great, but you still need the people to come and fill it. And you still need the authors, the illustrators, the designers, the marketeers, all of those people to do that. Yes, I come up with some great ideas sometimes, but creative is something that I don't know I would be putting under my bio.
I think it's such a difficult one, because I think at school or in like a traditional learning setting, if you are, you know, you're good at drawing pictures, or you play an instrument, or you're on the dance team, then you'll be told by someone you're creative.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't look at someone who's incredible at solving maths problems as creative.
True.
But yet they're looking at things
in a creative way.
To create something new.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that really can hinder people. Because if you're told that you're not creative
in that artistic, maybe necessarily sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It can stay with you. I need to walk along the little corner.
Yeah.
Because you've told me that
I'm not. Yeah. I was definitely not a maths person though. Like, I definitely always erred towards the quote unquote. It's funny because, like you say, I did always err towards the English or the arts side of things, but still would never call myself a creative, you know, even though I absolutely was awful at anything science. Like, and I did, at one point I thought I was going to be a doctor until I did my work experience at Guy's Hospital and passed out at the sight of blood. And I was like, well, that's the end of that. And so they put me then in the, very short sidetrack story, they put me in the Evelina Children's Hospital and they have a school in there. And so then I went around reading with the kids and I absolutely loved that. Doing the blood taking and all of that, absolutely not. Can still probably do a nurse's corner on a bed, but in terms of all of the other stuff, no. But working with the kids, I think, has always, even when I was a child, been something that I much rather enjoyed doing. So yeah, quick sidestep story for you there. That was the end of that.
No, I'm with you. How do you foster a creative environment for everyone else in the Knights of team?
That has been really tricky through the pandemic, and something that I think we took for granted, that we used to actually, at one point, this bookshop space was configured to have an office, and this bookcase to the right of me was midway through the shop, and we had a table here and we would work. And we were like, the people behind the books making the books, very corny. Yeah, we definitely took for granted that we was in this atmosphere, like we would see the kids coming in, and yes, it was distracting, but it kind of helped spark ideas really organically. Being in Brixton will help spark ideas really organically. We would go to bookshops, and like, we had that freedom to kind of engage with ideas as they came to us, and we could, you know, engage ourselves with local events that were happening, or local theatre, local music, and that kept us creative. And I think what we recognized maybe a little too late into the pandemic was that we weren't able to do that, you know, like we were all sat on a Zoom call
staring into the black,
staring literally just like being like, why is this, you know, at points friction coming up, like why are we not able to communicate as effectively? And it was because it's like, I remember at one point we were having calls left, right and center until we were all like, hold on a minute, do we actually need to speak to each other 5 times a day? Because whilst we were used to just being able to ask a question over the table, it was like, how do we now do that when we're not physically together? And so I think we did realize, maybe not too late, but it took us a while to realize, oh, actually what we're missing is the physical being of, you know, with each other. And so we then put in like a Zoom call once a week, which is absolutely nothing to do with work. It's just a, hi, how are you? How's your weekend? What have you been up to? What are you watching? What are you reading at the moment? Like, how are you? And I think you would ask that every day when you're in an office, like, oh, how are you doing? But when we were all behind a screen, it was really hard. It gets lost. It does get lost. And you can just become focused about work, which is something that we've never just been. And so now we are still kind of in that middle space where we don't have an office yet. And that's something that we're working towards for like the last quarter of the year. So I know that the physical coming together will really help with that, but also we are meeting up more regularly to work together. And sometimes those working days aren't always just work, but it's realizing that actually it's really important to have that time where you can just catch up with the people behind the role, because I think it's really easy to forget that we're all just people. And that, yes, I might be managing director, yes, you might be editorial director, yes, you might be creative director or design assistant, but you're you before you are that title. And so hanging out with each other and sharing things that we might be reading, eating, food is a big part of my life, or watching is just as important at the moment. But yes, the office, please, the office needs to manifest itself come September, so that we can, number one, have a place to put our award, but also have a space where we can, which feels like our own, because co-working spaces are great, but we need a space now that is our own, where we can feel free to have conversation and to have creativity and to create space for that as well.
And you're looking in Brixton?
We are looking any and everywhere that will have us. Yeah. I mean, Brixton would be great, but we have a team from everywhere. And whilst I am South London, I am not sure that everyone else would enjoy that. But Brixton would be the first choice, yeah. And then going from there to where everyone else can get into.
So a big question.
Oh, not a big one.
As we say, Knights of began out of ongoing, sustained frustration from you and as we say, looking at the building blocks that have already been put in place by other people to tell really great stories. What would you say to someone else who is frustrated either in publishing or in a completely different industry, who is frustrated, doesn't feel like they're being heard, or can see what they know to be a good answer, or a step in the right direction, but doesn't know how to get that moving?
I would always say find community first. And I think that's something that I maybe didn't do early enough, is finding support in maybe someone who is in the same role as you, someone who is within from within the same community as you. Because I think having conversations like this, whilst your workplace may tell you our ears are open, our doors are open, it can be really hard to go up to a senior person to be like, I am brand new here, but I've noticed all of these things that aren't working and that aren't right. Because ultimately, like, we want to make this industry better, right? And that's what the people within it want to do. But in doing that, you need to make sure that you are equipping yourself with people who support that around you. So I would say, first and foremost, find someone to talk to about it. And they can be within your team, or they can be, like I said, from within your community, or they can be somebody on Twitter that you are like, oh, I hope that this person would be able to help me in some way. And I think finding someone to share your frustration with is the first thing that you should do. And then being realistic as well in expectation. Like, I try to not expect anything from this industry. I know they don't owe me anything. And I know that oftentimes, even though we don't talk about money, oftentimes a lot of some people's why is derived from money. And so in order to matter, you have to appeal to their financial brain. And so if it doesn't appeal to their financial brain, sometimes relying on ethos and morals doesn't cut it. So it's being realistic in that whilst you may care really deeply about something, it's knowing that someone else may not. And like, I have had conversations where I've said, you know, I don't get it. I don't get why more people aren't invested in changing this. And I had someone really frankly tell me it's because, well, they don't care. And I think that really shocked and rocked me to hear somebody so blatantly, but, well, they don't care. So why would they do this? And I try to remember that for some people, they just really don't care. And so whilst you may care deeply about a thing, realize that somebody else who you're trying to convince may not. And then, you know, as much as I can be a bit cynical, be hopeful that the place that you occupy, the space that you occupy, is uniquely yours to do with what you want. Like I say, I see KO as like a legacy thing. Like, really think about the career that you want to carve out and think about the mark that you want to leave within the industry, if that's something that you care about. If you are in kids publishing and you're like, I always try to say, if you're in kids publishing, think about the kids, because they are the ones that are picking up the books, they are the ones that are engaging. It's just the adults who are the nightmare. And if we can remember that it's the kids that we're doing this for, then that will help with motivation as well. And if you're in adult publishing, I don't know about you guys, I'm sorry. I think just remembering that you're not alone in this as well is really, really helpful, and that there are people, like, my DMs are open and I talk to a lot of people all the time who are in those corporate spaces and are still having those struggles. And I have to realize now that I am in a privileged position now where the culture that we've created at Knights of, you know, microaggressions are fortunately something that we don't perpetuate and we don't allow, and that a lot of the conversations that were forced to explain why diversity or inclusion matters, they just don't happen. But I know that that is a privileged space which I exist in now, which is like a little hard to contend with, because I rarely see myself. Anyway, we'll deal with that in another episode. But like, I have to realize that the environment that I work in is not the same as many of my peers and the companies that they're in publishing. So like I said, my DMs are always open for people to talk to me about the small things, but also like the big ideas as well, because the ideas that we have at KO aren't like, I always say that I don't care if anyone wants to copy paste the things that we've done at KO. Like, I really like, there's so much room for so many iterations and so many versions of what we do to exist, that if you want to copy paste it, because that's only ever going to result in more great books.
Exactly.
And that is a good thing, you know.
To talk about books, it's a final question.
That's a bit nice.
Who's an author you're championing? 2022
author. We are actually this week on tour with Alake Pilgrim, who is a Trinidadian based author who has written Zoe and the Forest of Secrets for us, and she is one of our big debuts of this year, of this summer. She's written a beautifully atmospheric story of a young girl called Zoe and a boy that she comes across in the forest called AG. And amongst a lot of things, there were talking spiders, which really grossed me out when I was reading it. But Alake actually came to us in a way that is really organic to KO, in that we have open submissions, we have a live chat, and she is like our live chat success story, in that she kind of sent us a message, Isha picked it up, and they worked together on an idea. She wrote it up. She now has an agent. And now we've published her book. And so it goes to show that you can be that person who sends us a DM, sends us a live chat message, and then become a published author. And then later in the year, we are publishing a collection of stories from an organization called Milk Honey Bees. And we are publishing a book called Girlhood Unfiltered, which is the stories of young Black girls told by them. And the organization is run by a young woman called Ebonita Iyere. Sorry if I've got your surname wrong, Ebonita. She creates space for young Black girls to live out their lives as they want to, and to help facilitate conversations on their emotions and their whole personhood and their whole identity. Working with them on a campaign for Empress and Anaya last year, something that we heard from them was that there are a lot of books for them, but that don't actually center their voices. So it's a lot of people looking back at when they were younger, but not actually talking to them. And they were like, if we want to talk about us, we want to hear ourselves. And so Girlhood Unfiltered will be published towards the end of this year. And working with those girls has been incredible, because they range from like 9 to 15.
So cool. You get for them as well.
Oh my God, they flaunting the fact that they're going to be published authors. They 100%. Love it.
Can you imagine?
They absolutely love it. But like I was saying earlier, they have language for things that I never had language for as a kid. And they are so vocal in what they see their wants and needs as. And so working with them has been a huge honor.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been incredible to come and to see what
to be in the midst.
Exactly. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed learning more about Amy's experience, taking her frustrations with the lack of representation in children's books and turning that into Nights Of and Roundtable Books. You can find out more about what Amy and the team are working on over on their social channels @_nightsof. And if you found this episode useful, please let us know @artistinreside on all social media channels. Your feedback helps us to create an even more exciting roster of guests and to help give you the tools you need to bring your own project to life. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.